Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Contract Revolution. My name is Benji. My guest on the show today is Ken Rusk, a lifelong contractor and the author of the new book, Blue Collar Cash: Love Your Work, Secure Your Future, and Find Happiness for Life. For the past few decades, we've been steering kids towards university and away from the trades. But why? The average North American college graduate is underskilled and in debt, especially when you compare them to their blue-collar friends who just skipped the whole college experience and got themselves on the job site. So the question we're trying to answer today, is blue-collar work making a comeback? Ken thinks so, but there's a whole lot more to the story. Listen to the whole episode to find out why.
You're listening to Contractor Evolution, where we unpack the systems, tactics, and skills you need to take your fast-growing contracting business to the next level.
If you're here to learn what it takes to scale up, work less, and increase profitability, you've come to the right place.
Stay tuned to learn what separates the new breed of contractor from the old school, and welcome to your ultimate guide on the business of contracting.
Ken, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Great, Benji. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
An easy one to start, okay? Where does the term blue collar originally come from?
You know, that's an interesting thing. When I first wrote the book, Blue Collar Cash, I actually wanted to research that. And, you know, way back in the day, if you were a highly educated person, you had an office job or a professional, you had these suits on and you had these white, thick, snap-on collars that you would wear. And so that was kind of like high society. That would kind of signify that you were a white collar person. Conversely, if you were working, building bridges or roads or doing whatever you were doing with your hands, you typically wore blue jeans, and they had blue jean shirts back in the day. They called them dungarees or Levi's. And those were blue collar clothes, and that's what they wore. So they would consider those people blue collar.
So there actually were blue collars at some point in time. Blue collars and white collars.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Sure.
So the book is called Blue Collar Cash, Love Your Work, Secure Your Future, and Find Happiness for Life. Why did you write it, and who is it for?
Really big question. And I wrote it because, you know, when I started my business in 86, I had six people. I now have 220. And you hire a lot of people in 37 years to do what we do, which is basically we're ditch diggers. I mean, it's been a great ride, but you learn a lot about people along the way, and you learn how prepared people are for life. And I could see a steady decline in how prepared people were for life over the last 5 or 10 years. And I could also see this blue collar crisis that we were having that kind of went unnoticed. As shop classes were disappearing from high schools, and people, instead of building tree forts in the backyard, they were building, you know, cities on Minecraft sitting on the couch, which isn't the same experience. And, then colleges got really good at hoodwinking parents into believing that college was the single only way to be successful. And if you didn't send your kid through my school, he or she would be a loser the rest of their life. So I felt it was time to speak up for the amazing and super lucrative careers that are still out there today. And so I wrote the book in that light. Now, there are basically three readers. I mean, if you're going to start out looking for what you want to do with your life, I propose that you first off visualize what you want your life to look like, and then find one of the many paths to go get there instead of the opposite of that, which is backwards. So that's a younger reader looking to get out into the world. Another reader is someone who maybe went to college and now is on the 15th floor in some cubicle, and they hate what they're doing. They hate their life. They have a lot of debt, and they would rather have been out in the field working with their hands like they did when they were in their teens or early 20s. But the coolest reader that we didn't expect was the business owner who says, I can't do it all. I don't want to do it all. I realize that my ego is preventing me from taking this company to the next level. I want to surround myself with intrapreneurs, not entrepreneurs. Intrapreneurs, these are people that want to work within your company, want to have some control, want to have some results, want to maybe share in some of those results, and subsequently take your company way further than you can take it yourself. And I experienced that firsthand. So You know, we've gotten a lot of companies that are out there kind of book clubbing this thing where they first read the book and then they have all their employees take my course, which is only 8 sessions long, but it literally changes your whole persona of your business, because now people are saying to themselves, I'm going to work for me, myself first, and the company second. And that's okay, because as long as they're winning within your organization, you are definitely and always going to win in the end.
Who's the is the course for like workers, or is it for the business owner, or both?
Well, if you read the book, you'll understand, as an owner, you'll understand that there are certain things that you're looking for in an entrepreneur, okay? There are certain things that you want to surround yourself with character-wise, things like persistence, resilience, faith, courage, vision, initiative, you know, generosity, all those kinds of things. Those are the entrepreneurial basics that people have that I think we all have. The difference is, if you don't find a reason why they want those characteristics to come out, then they kind of stay buried inside of them until they just get lucky and something happens to them. So the from an owner's perspective, you would want to guide your students or your employees through this course, and then keep your eyes open, because you're going to see those people are going to rise to the top. You're going to see the people that you want to surround yourself with, and then do this. And I did this myself. Pick a number. Your company is at a certain level of revenue now, right? You know what that is. Have them surround you in a meeting room somewhere. Have them all write down on a piece of paper, if you guys could do what you wanted to do with this company, how much further do you think you could take it than it is today? How much could we do more next year than we are this year? Mm-hmm. You will find that their numbers, have them write them down on a piece of paper and keep them in their hand, you will find that their numbers will be way higher than your number was. And I learned that lesson. And the cool thing about that was, I said, okay, I'm going to share a piece of that newfound revenue with you. And then it was game on. It was like, Ken, thanks for the training. Now get the hell out of my way and let me go do this. And that was probably the coolest result of Blue Collar Cash that I got out of it.
I want to key into this thing you said, steady decline and preparedness, in a sec here. But first, I got to talk about my outfit, as always. So, guys, wardrobe today is provided by Prattco Excavating. It's owned by Jarrett Pratt. Let me read a few notes from him. We were texting this morning. So he says, our business runs off a residential and commercial division. Our residential side specializes in excavation of single-family homes, roughly 2,000 a year. That's a lot of digging. Our commercial side, we specialize in underground parkades, new school sites, commercial retail buildings, and logistics warehouses. Live and operate in Calgary. Been a Breakthrough Academy member since December of 2022. In terms of growth, since joining Breakthrough Academy, we went from 22.7 mil in 2022 to 29 mil last year in 23, tracking for 33 million in 2024. Way to go, Jared. That is a big business. The biggest thing that Breakthrough Academy has helped me with is just the accountability. I believe sometimes when you're at the top of your business, nobody is asking you the why or the how. Having a coach like Craig White allows me to bounce ideas off of someone who can view my business from afar, that isn't a Prattco Excavating employee. Sometimes the answers to your problems is so simple and you just need someone outside of the business to tell you what you need to do. Secondly, adding goal setting and review meetings have been a real help. It's allowed me to connect with my team on a more personal level, as well as clearly lay out my expectations for them. Okay, thank you for the sick outfit. This is a really nice Carhartt, Jarrett. I appreciate it. If you want to work with 600 other amazing contractors like Jarrett, you want to check out Breakthrough Academy, you click the link below. You can learn all about it. Okay, Ken, I want to ask you this. Steady decline in preparedness. I'm going to set this question up this way. For a few generations now, I don't know when this began, but for a few generations now, young people in North America were told to go to college. And although I don't think this was said explicitly by parents and coaches and educators, it was sort of heavily implied to almost avoid the trades, avoid hands-on work, avoid working with your hands, working with your body. Now, but here's the thing. Here's the catch. If you look And I would love it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. If you look at the mental, spiritual, financial state of your average North American college graduate right now, debt laden, underskilled, lacking competence, which leads to a lack in confidence, which leads to some, like, a lot of this sort of mental health stuff we're hearing about. I'm not saying this is the only factor. Okay. I want to be clear. This is a complex issue, but I'm thinking of the average 22, 23 year old right now, who's just come out of university with a B.com, BA, B, whatever. I think it's fair to say they are struggling to thrive, many of them. So here's the question. It's very, very clear to me that that was and still is really bad advice. Where do you think that advice came from? Like, how did we get this so wrong? Are we just sort of like, was that just a terrible idea, or has the world changed? Or like, how do you kind of explain that?
Well, a couple of things. So I wrote an open letter to parents on my website, kenruss.com, a while back. And one of the things that I said was, I get it. You know, you're running around in your friend circles. You birthed your children. You raised your children. You sheltered your children. You clothed your children. You fed them. And you educated them as far as you could. And you think now that the only way you can show your face in society and say, I'm a good parent, is if your child has an expensive degree on the wall. That has never been true in the history of our country. It isn't true now, and it certainly isn't going to be true in the near future. Having said that, when you take shop class out of high school and you replace those rooms with computers, you've set people up to say, well, wow, I mean, I used to walk down this hallway and I could see someone changing a transmission on a Mustang. I could see someone milling a table leg for a kitchen table. I could see somebody wiring an outlet or doing some hair or nails, or I could see someone welding. Now, those rooms were interchanged with just computers, which kind of led us down this white collar only path at a very young age, 13, 14, 15, 16. So you took away the chance for millions of kids to accidentally discover how cool working with your hands is, working with trades. So you take that out of the equation. Colleges jumped all over that. And they thought, wow, okay, now we're gonna influence these high schools to now start calling themselves college prep schools. Now, I can tell you this about a college prep school. Nothing changes from where it used to be. Just because you put the word college prep on the school doesn't mean anything changed at all, okay? Other than the teachers started talking college, 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 college. Well, between you and I, a 13-year-old should not be asked what they're going to be doing for the rest of their life. Okay. A 14 or 15, 16 year old should not be asked that question. They should be discovering these things to try to figure out where they're going. So you literally eliminated those choices from millions of kids from ever happening. Well, now what's left? What's left is, well, I guess I have to send my kid to college because everybody else is doing the same thing. That's where the problem is. And this is the result of that. We've now overproduced these bland business degrees by the millions. And when you overproduce something, the dollar for it actually falls.
Exactly.
So now you have kids expecting to make 75, 80 grand a year coming out of college that are now making 50 because they're a dime a dozen. They're everywhere. Conversely, if you remember, you know, supply and demand from high school, you know, ninth grade, 101 econ said where supply is low and demand is high, that's where the money goes. So now you can take advantage of that, jump into a trade, and, you know, would you rather pay 40 grand a year for college all in, have 160,000 in debt when you're done, and maybe a job you can't find? Or would you rather make 40 grand a year right out of the gate, go 50, 60, 70 in 4 years, now you're 200 to the plus side? That's like a $300-$400 swing from the negative side of your asset base to the positive side. So all I'm saying is, at least consider that before you just blindly follow the herd.
Can you add any insight or data or research or stories just from your own lived experience, or perhaps conversations you've had through the writing and speaking that you've done? Like, is there anything else you would say about how these two groups are doing in the world today? The sort of the college graduate and more like the blue collar, hands-on, tradesy kid.
Well, yeah, look at it this way. So we already know that 65% of blue-collar workers are very happy in their life, and we know that 35% of white-collar workers are happy in their life. Right there, there's an imbalance, and here's the reason why. When you work in a trade, for the most part, you have control. You have control over your input. You have control over your output and the quality of that output. You have control over the pace, the time, the schedule, your day. You usually have control over your financial gain if you know what you're doing. And that just isn't necessarily true, again, in the 15th floor of one of those cubicles. You're waiting for everybody else to react to who you are instead of you proacting to who you are. And I think that's the biggest difference. You can live a reactionary life climbing a corporate ladder, which for some is good because the security fits them. Or you can live proactively and get out into the world and say, I'm going to make my own life happen. I'm not going to wait for life to just happen to me. I'm going to happen to my life. Okay. You know, you hear about this if-then scenario. If I go to high school, if I get good grades, if I get a scholarship, if I get a college degree, and then if that college degree gives me a job, and then if that job pays me well, well, then, Benji, I can live my life. That's the complete opposite. You need to know what your then looks like now first, draw that out crystal clearly, and then find one of the many paths to go get it. Because at the end of the day, and this is where what I say is controversial sometimes, I don't care so much what you do for a living. I'm more concerned about what you do with what you do for a living. Mm-hmm. Because gaining the life that you want for yourself, that's the true win in the end.
Mm-hmm. When you talk to young people, either in your business or maybe it's at a book signing or just in your life in general, I'm talking like a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, all the way to like a mid-20-year-old. You're talking to young people about the real career opportunities that present themselves in trades, in construction, in home services. What do you tell them? Like, what do you talk about? How do you frame it? What's kind of like this the story that you tell?
My story is real simple. You know, everything in life is risk reward, okay? Everything is do it and get it, okay? There is no somebody that's just going to walk up to you and straighten your life out and make it the way that, you know, that they want it to be, and you should never allow that anyway. I tell them this. I say, look it. You and only you know what your favorite house is going to be, a house in the country, a house in a suburb, an apartment in the city. You and only you know what your favorite mode of transportation might be, pickup truck, minivan, motorcycle, electric car, whatever. You and only you know your favorite color, your favorite type of vacation. You and only you know what your favorite pet might be, your favorite hobby, your favorite sport, your favorite pastime, your favorite charity or your favorite give back moment. Why are you relying so much on other people to set your life the way you want it? Because what happens is you become this reactive, non-thinking, no spontaneity, kind of like impulse person. You don't get to say, I'm going to sit down and think about what I want my life to look like, because ultimately it is my life. Okay. I'm going to get kicked out of the nest at some point, and it's going to be up to me. So It is true that I do control what my future looks like, because I'm the only one that knows what that perfect nirvana might be, or what I call comfort, peace, and freedom in the book. So I encourage them to sit down, draw that out, draw the brochure that is their life crystal clearly, edit it as you go, and then make that be your focus, not necessarily what other people want for you.
If this is all true, and I believe that it is, 65% of blue-collar workers are happy, 35% of white-collar workers are happy. You talk about the supply and demand forces driving up price for one category, not the other. And I'm very plugged into this world, obviously. Like, I know that this is true. Why is there still a skilled labor shortage? Like, if the path is this good, why aren't more people taking it?
Well, I can tell you this. I know that the tide is turning because colleges have gotten caught.
Right.
And here's how they've gotten caught. They're admitting 40% of their students that have no idea why they're going. Okay. Right. That's a problem. They're also experiencing 25% of their college students are changing their degree in the first year or two. That's another waste of mom and dad's money or the government's money, right? But the worst one is the most insidious of all. only 33% of degree earners ever use their degree in their lifetime ever. So that means there's a whole lot of degrees out there that people are selling to people that their people are paying for that just never get used. So if you think about that piece, that is a pretty inefficient system. Any other business that had that kind of report card would fail. Okay. Mm-hmm. And yet they have this altruistic hold on parents and teachers. In some cases, they're influencing and incentivizing high schools to create people to go to their schools. So it's a bad system, but people are onto it now.
Yeah.
People are understanding that they're coming out with all this debt when their neighbor's kid now has 6 vans and 12 employees and he's making $200,000 a year with his own plumbing contracting business. So they're getting caught,
I should say,
in the inefficiencies of their effectiveness.
The jig is up. And I think people are getting hip to that, getting wise to that rather quickly. The other sort of wrinkle to this, which is really interesting, and I've sort of been thinking about this. I don't know if this is a fully baked idea yet. I don't have research to back it. This is just a take, so take it with a grain of salt. But you know, if you look at the number one jobs that are getting displaced right now by AI, they're all information workers. It's paralegals, it's x-ray technicians. It is a lot of, somebody explained it to me incredibly well 6 months ago or so. He said, anywhere where the data is centralized is ripe for disruption through AI. And if you look at just, let's say, the housing stock in the US, That is not centralized data. That data is out there in reality. There is no master spreadsheet for where all the pipes are. You know, each municipality has their own. Some of them are accurate, some of them are not. Like, there's a lot still about this that is not ripe for disruption. And the other thing that this gentleman told me is the day and time. You know, we live in this sort of like content world where everyone's listening to podcasts and we all listen to tech bros and everyone makes it seem like tomorrow we're all going to live in a simulation. I'm not in that camp, as my listeners know. What he was saying is like we're a long way off from having AI be smart enough to then be layered on top of robotics, which are good enough, where they're going to be the guy in the truck doing the plumbing. Like that's not this decade. It's probably not even next decade. So if you're looking for things that are quote unquote AI resilient or AI proof, or at least have a longer runway, this seems like a good one. And I wonder, I don't know if you thought about this, Ken, like, could you almost see a bit of a resurgence, a swinging of the pendulum back to blue collar and tradesy work as the information workers are getting displaced left, right, and center?
Well, I think any economy that has that tries to remain balanced will have that pendulum swing back and forth. There's no doubt. Unless some of the forces are manipulative. And you know, again, I'm not anti-college. If you're going to operate on my shoulder so I can get back out on the golf course, I want you to know everything there is to know about a knife before you come at me with it. Okay, so trust me. Or if you're going to be an engineer that builds buildings, or you're going to be a teacher or whatever, yeah, that should be a pathway for you. But having said that, I do believe that we're in a place where these jobs are going to be resilient for a long time. I mean, you think about it. When you show up with a truck full of pine trees and a bunch of boulders and mulch and dirt in front of someone's house and you want to create a beautiful landscape, I just don't see a robot getting out of the truck and designing that and doing all that anytime soon. So, and making on the job, you know, changes or design changes or alterations, you know, what I see AI doing is what I just heard the other day. So you could be on the roof needing a piece of plywood that isn't 4x8, but let's say it's 3.5x6 because you need this piece. So you could just stare at that thing with these goggles. It will then transfer that information down to the guy on the ground who's cutting the plywood. And then he'll make that piece of plywood for you without you having to climb down or yell over the edge or have unnecessary steps in a dangerous situation. I see AI only enhancing these types of jobs, not replacing it. I mean, I don't know how happy you would be someone coming up trying to, you know, cut your hair as a robot or something like that. But I only see these types of technologies. You know, it's almost like swinging a hammer versus having one of those lightweight nail guns. I mean, I see that type of technology increasing, but not necessarily replacing.
So here's a very practical question for our listeners who are all business owners like you. How do we as entrepreneurs do a better job telling this story, painting a brighter picture of a future in trades and construction, and using that to attract the talent that these businesses so desperately need? What have you found really useful in the organizations that you run to sort of like get the people in the building?
Well, you know, I will tell you this. So it used to be that I could put an ad in the paper and in the foyer, there'd be 6-7 people the next morning, like guaranteed. Well, now that doesn't work so much anymore because they passed 22, you know, hiring signs on the way to my office from the freeway. So there's a lot of competition out there, obviously. But I will say this, the way we interview is completely different. You know, I used to be able to, and I don't ever remember really doing this because it wasn't my personality, but I've seen people like, hey, why should I hire you? What are you going to bring to this company? Well, it's different now. I mean, it's almost like the people coming in for jobs are looking back at me and saying, hey, dude, what's in it for me to work here? And that's okay, because unless you have that ego that you just can't believe you got to ask that question, I look at it this way. That's an opportunity for you to answer. And if you can answer that question, you might be onto something there, because, well, let me show you what's in it for you to work here. Mm-hmm. I actually believe that we don't ask them, why are you here? I think so many times our interviews are like this. Well, the work hours are these hours, and this is your uniform, and this is what kind of health insurance you get, and this is what the job entails, and this is your lunch break, and here's your vacation. The heck with that. Look at the other two-thirds of the human. I mean, if you think about a human being, they have 3 8-hour shifts in their day. They have their work day, basically. They have their sleeping day and part of their day, and then they have their activity part of their day. I look at the whole person. Why would you hire a human being and only get one-third of them when you can get the whole person? And so for me, when I interview, I want to know what their background is. I want to know what their hobbies, their sports. I want to know what they're after. I want to know what their crystal clear goals look like. I want to know what their brochure looks like that is to be their life, so that I can say, well, I'm going to help you get that. And I can tell you, when you ask those questions, people look back at you like, who are you? Like you invented penicillin, okay? It's really refreshing to see people go, wow, this guy cares about me, and so he's asking me to be selfish right now. Not at the detriment of others, but he's asking me to think about me first, Meaning the employee and the company second. Because when you do that, if you get enough people that can win with and through your organization, that's where the real magic is. If for you to go home and say, man, I worked 78 hours this week and beat your chest and do all that, yeah, that's great. But you know, you might make a few dollars, but you're going to kill yourself in the process. I'm talking about surrounding yourself with this entrepreneurial spirit, allowing the company to provide for people for themselves, and then get out of the way and let them do it. It's hard for people. It's hard for business owners to understand this. But if you really want your company to fly, get ready for this, okay? You have to make yourself as irrelevant to your business as you can, as quickly as you can, because then and only then do you have the freedom to float above it, look back down and say, wow, I'm going to plug myself in where I want to plug myself in. That's true vision. That's true leadership, getting out of the trenches and trying to drive this thing forward with the help of those people around you.
One of the things you talk about quite a bit in the book is like visioning. And I think what you're doing in a few of the chapters is encouraging young carpenters, plumbers, painters, landscapers, whatever. I'm not even necessarily young, shouldn't say that qualifier, just people in the trades to get really, really clear on what their ideal life looks like. You talk about what's your dream home, what are your dream hobbies. You mentioned it earlier in this interview. Is that something that you kind of force the issue on as a leader with the people in your business? Like, because I think a lot of people aren't, you know, to go back to our education system, it doesn't do a great job teaching us how to do that stuff, how to get really crystal clear on my ideal life and think about the marriage I want, the health I'd like to enjoy, the travel I'd like to experience, the type of kids I'd want to raise, the yada, 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 the list goes on. Is that a responsibility that you think is now on the shoulders of business owners to help their teams, to help their employees get clear on? And if so, like, how do you do it?
Well, I think if you want to thrive, it is. Yeah, I really do. I think if you recognize that you can't do it all as a single person entrepreneur, then yeah, I believe it is your responsibility to do it. But I would just say this. So there's a difference between asking somebody what they want and putting it down in an exact format. I have these giant black glass boards. They remind me of, you know, like in front of a Mexican restaurant where they have the neon markers and you write the special margarita special of the day. So I have these boards on the walls, and when you write a goal up, you have to write it in a crystal clear fashion. This is what I mean by that. So I have somebody that wants to go to Italy, and it's going to cost them $4,000 to go. Okay, so they're saving $40 a week, okay, for 2 years. There's the $4,000. They have a start date. They have an end date. They go to the bookkeeper to take the $40 a week out, so now it's live. That $40 a week can't go anywhere but into this particular place. They sign it, they date it, they put it on the board, and it's there for every other employee in the building to see. So now you've got clarity. First off, congratulate yourself for getting that far, because most people don't get that far. Now you've got clarity, you've got action. This thing has become live. Are you sharing it with 200 other people? And they can see that, oh man, look at you. You're like halfway to going to Italy. Because you and I both know a year flies by in the blink of an eye, yeah. Right? So now once they do one of those, I've got people that have come back around their fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth goal because they're just addicted to the anticipation, okay? We all know how to plan a vacation, Benji, right? You know, we think about the beach and the sunglasses and our favorite bathing suit and the towel and the chair and the palm trees blowing in the wind and the ocean breeze and the sound of the ocean and the smell of the copper tone number 8 and maybe that margarita they're going to drink, whatever, right? You know what that is, and you know how to plan that 3-4 months out. And then what do? You look forward to it. Well, if you define the word look forward, you're actually anticipating something in the future. Why can't you live your whole life like that? Why can't you live all of the things that should come into your life in the same fashion? So if you get a lot of people surrounding you in your company that are all anticipating some awesome event, it is powerful, extremely powerful. So you just start small, start with paying off a credit card, start with doing something small, and then, man, get out of the way, because now they're buying houses, they're buying cars, they're going on trips, they're doing all these amazing things because you led them to that place. But then they end up doing it. So it's a win-win for everybody.
It certainly makes digging the ditches a little bit easier.
Oh, big time. Yeah, big time.
There's a theme in the book which I by the way, guys, like I'm sort of heavily endorsing that you read, and I actually think even more importantly, you get your teams to read. And I'll sort of say why with this question. There's a theme in the book. You talk about being comfortable in your own skin, and I actually want to like share a little bit, just like a personal story. I'm going to talk about my brother Jeremy, who my brother Jer is a very tradesy guy, very hands-on, very mechanically inclined. In our family, he is always the person who gets the text or the phone call when something is broken. He is wired that way, always has been, very, very, very talented. Was an amazing woodworker as a kid, and it took him, you know, he's 2.5 years younger than me, so he's turning 28. I would say, I didn't ask him if I can share this, but that's fine. It'll be okay. Yeah, he really struggled in his mid-20s to kind of like get comfortable in his own blue collar skin. And in the last 6 months, he's landed a really good job with a really good builder where we live. He is on a team and in a group where he's being taught things and where he's learning things, and he's like loving it. Like it's been really, really nice as an older brother to kind of see, some confidence come back, see some like ownership and some comfort and some like, no, like this is who I am. Like, I like this. And I'm really good at this. And I like, this is cool. Like, this is not something that I need to like sort of be ashamed about, or I have to like talk around, or I have to make sound more glitzy than it is. And another side to this too is like, he, you know, our family is kind of like businessy. Like, my dad was a consultant, and I have cousins in real estate, and there's sort of like a white collar spin to a lot of people in the family. And for my brother Jer, like, that's not who he is. And I don't think that he would say that's who he is. But here's where I'm going with this. It took him quite a while to just like settle into that and own it. And now that he has, it's like so much better for him. He would tell you the same thing. It's a better look for him. He feels better. And I wonder, the reason I'm sharing that question, sharing that story, Ken, is to ask you this question. Like, do you think other young people have a hard time getting comfortable in their own blue collar skin? And how do you solve for that? How do you help someone in a situation like that? If you could give my brother advice 2 years ago, or someone else who's in that situation right now, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I guess I would point to my own experience, because, you know, when I'm at the country club with a bunch of surgeons and bankers and financial guys and whatever, and they ask me what I do, and I tell them that I dig ditches for a living. I mean, you know, I do it on purpose now.
Yeah, like, because, it's a bit, like, it's a joke because, for you.
Yeah, because my world is really good, and all of the blue collar friends that I have that own blue collar businesses are all just killing it. To the point now where some of these guys are going, why did I go to medical school, man? Look at what you guys are doing. The point I'm getting at is, nobody ever rolled up into my driveway. And I have to tell you, I mean, I'm just going to throw this out there. I have a pretty cool house. I've got a bunch of cool cars. I mean, I do a lot of really cool things. And that's just my world. That's just my thing. But nobody ever rolled up into my driveway and said, wow, man, what degree do you have? Okay, that's never happened. They might ask me, man, Ken, how did you grind this life out? And I'm happy to tell them that. But the bottom line is, the more you understand that your life is in your control, which is what your brother is realizing, the more you get it, that things like time and freedom and peace and comfort, those are all assets. Those are all, you know, that's money. That's actual currency. And the more you get that you're beholden to yourself. So I might say to myself, okay, I'm 5'8" and a half on a good day. I am never going to dunk a basketball.
Right.
I mean, unless I jump on top of LeBron's shoulders, and then I'm not going to dunk a basketball. So therefore, I don't try. But what I do is I focus on creating the absolute most perfect version of Ken Rusk that I can be. Mm-hmm. So having that as my focus, I don't ever compare myself to Facebook people or Instagram people. I mean, I know there's a lot of that going on. But once you understand that the best things that you can see for your best life are known to you and you only. I mean, how many people would walk up to you and guess your favorite color?
Right.
I'm guessing none. Okay. So why are we letting other people influence the direction in which our life travels? So I would say your brother's probably coming into the point where he's saying, I get who I am. I know who I am. And oh, by the way, because of that, I'm starting to knock down a few more dollars here. I'm starting to get a little more confidence. I'm starting to acquire some things that I wanted in my life. And I realized just now, I'm in control of this thing, man. Nobody else is. So I really feel that it's, and if we just allow people that freedom, that arena to get there, which we don't do when they're young, because we try to just force them into these other square pegs. That's the problem that I have with it. But I do think it's getting better.
People are struggling to find meaning in their lives. They're having a really hard time feeling connected. They're sort of spiritually lost. I mean, not everyone, I'm generalizing, but you know what I'm talking about. People are having a hard time living in the abstraction that we would associate with modern life. Do you think that people who do hands-on work, they build stuff or they make stuff or they fix stuff, find meaning more easily?
Well, I can tell you this. When I was working on landscape crews as a kid, we were lucky because we worked for a landscape architect that did really big projects. I mean, big houses, big projects, like I was talking about earlier, boulders and pine trees by the hundreds and ponds and, you know, we made these little mini rivers and stuff. I got to tell you, when you could stand back, and I call this the stand back moment, when it's, you know, let's say it's quitting time and you all lean back and you put all your tools away and you lean on that shovel and you turn around and you look back at what you just created, you have that stand back moment and you say, you know what, man, I built that. That's going to stand the test of time. That is friggin' awesome. I'll come back 100 years from now and that'll be there. That is really so cool. I don't think people walking out of skyscrapers in New York have that same type of moment. I mean, I don't want to generalize the whole industry, but in general, to me, I don't think they have that same ability to come out and go, man, you know what? That piece part that I did and sent to Shanghai that went over to, I don't think you get the same kind of thing. So, and until you do that job, until you do a blue collar job, like I just said, you're never going to feel that. Yeah. You're never going to recognize that. You're never going to go, oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that's why I love it when I get people that write to me and say, I had one guy, he's 45 years old. He said, I went to school because my parents told me to. I didn't want to go to school. I have all this debt. I was a plumber's assistant when I was going through college. I loved it. I'm done with this sales job. I went back to being a plumber. And he goes, I'm having a time in my life. Thank you so much for allowing me to transition back to that.
Yeah.
So it is true. There is something to that. And again, I think it's because not only are they controlling their work, but they're also controlling other aspects of their life. And that's really the only way to live, Benji.
What can you say about the demand and supply forces at work right now in this economy for skilled trades? What does it mean for young people? And do you see this trend continuing?
Well, as long as kids sit around and stare at these things all day long, it's going to continue. Mm-hmm. Okay. As long as kids sit on the couch and don't do anything and just believe that somehow through this computer, their life is going to be better, it's going to be a problem. There's no doubt about that. I do see the pendulum swinging back a little bit. I will tell you this. I heard a rumor the other day that construction jobs are now topping $30 an hour, just regular construction jobs. That's $75,000 a year with a little bit of overtime.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I think it is coming back. I do think people need to take a hard look at it. I also think that technology, like I said earlier, you know, you're not lifting as much as you used to. You're not pushing as much as you used to. You're not pounding as much as you used to. So these jobs are easier on the body than they've ever been. I also think through, like myself personally, I do stem cells, I do exosomes, I do biologics, I do peptides, I do all that stuff. And that keeps me going. It keeps me strong. It keeps me healthy. I feel like I can hit the golf ball as far as I could when I was 20. So those are the kinds of things now that, you know, vitamins and food and whatever, awareness of who we are as human beings and health and all that. I do believe that that is going to change the stigma of, you know, the guy that you see that's 75 years old and he's a bricklayer and he's bent over and he's kind of beat up. That stuff's going to change because that's the only example that these kids have to look at right now. And I think that's going to change as things move forward.
That's a really interesting angle. I'd never thought of that. Okay, so that actually, you know, to my opening question, that sort of answers, you're hinting at something here that I hadn't thought of. When I'm saying like, hey, how did we screw this up? How did we give people this bad advice to avoid trades? On some level, it could be because we're looking at the guy who's hunched over and his body is broken and he's not financially set up for retirement and all that stuff. There's sort of this archetypal worker right. guy who is like doesn't look great. And I what you're saying is like through technology, through better building materials, through better tools that we're using, the nutritional right. stuff we know about, diet, sleep, exercise stuff that we know about, supplements, all this stuff, like there's actually a pathway to be super healthy and have longevity and all this stuff, even with the physical demands of these types of jobs.
Well, yeah, I mean, look at you find a guy from the 70s and 80s that played football for the Steelers or for the Raiders, okay? And you look at them today, they are broken human beings. I mean, they got so beat up and so injured and so hurt, and you couldn't repair. They didn't have half the technology that they have now. And now you look at guys like Tom Brady right. and Kirk Cousins and these guys that are playing later on into their life, and they're getting these big contracts because they are finding ways to use technology and health to keep them living longer, stronger in lives. So a quarterback from the 70s and 80s is a far cry from a quarterback in the 2020s as you spend time doing that job. And it's the same thing with contractors. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with the way we do our work. I mean, if you think about it, a bobcat with one driver can do the work of 10 guys that we used to do with just shovels and wheelbarrows. So those types of things will no doubt make being a contractor a much easier, better way to go. And then the other thing is the education. I mean, you know, it's no secret that you have between the time you're 21 and the time you're 63, you have 42 years of work, right? You also have 6 periods of 7-year increments. 42, 6 times 7, 42. That is 7 chances, or 6 chances, I should say, at 7 years apiece to double your money every 7 years.
Right.
Okay. If you miss out on that first one, then you big time miss out on the last one because, right. you know, that last one is the double that takes your money from 500 to a million, right? Not 125,000 to 250 like it does earlier on. So we have that education now to teach people. Take advantage of the power of young money and allow that to work for you so that when you are older and you are taking care of yourself, you don't have to rely on some of these public institutions to keep your longevity going or to keep your financial well-being going.
I love it. I have one final question here, which is a lot of our listeners are parents. How do you advise parents to talk about career paths with their kids? Because again, you're not bashing university and saying it's only that you have to do right. this or else, but you are highlighting that there is maybe more paths, more forks in the road than has been traditionally presented. So can you just tell us how you would advise people to talk about career paths with their kids?
Well, college has only ever been one of 6 paths. There's college, there's tech school, trade school, there's apprenticeships, there's a military career working right out of high school. So let's get that part. There's always been about 6 main arteries that lead to financial wealth building, okay? And college has only ever been one of them. The reason that is because there's 167 million people considered full employment in the United States today. 77 million of those people, as we sit here right now, Benji, still do work with their hands on a daily basis. So by the time you put your feet on the floor, getting out of bed, to the time you go to your church or office or school, you are going to walk or drive across 10,000 at least blue-collar jobs that are still viable today. Think about it. You know, there's the guy who drives the truck, but who builds the truck, but who builds the parts for the truck, but who builds the raw material to make the parts for the truck. So there are 10,000 jobs that are still very viable today. I would tell the parents, if you want your child to build true wealth, okay, and living well is their ultimate goal, okay, not how educated they are, but how well they live is the ultimate goal, in my opinion, then I would say be a contrarian thinker. I would say find out what everybody else isn't willing to do, okay, and because that's typically where the supply is problematic and where the demand is problematic and where the money goes. And when people say, well, Ken, but how exactly do I do that? You know, here's a trick, okay? Go to any Home Depot or Lowe's, go to the contractor desk, ask the guys behind the desk, hey, all those business cards on the wall over there, what's missing in this town? I mean, what are people not doing? Okay. What are people running out of? Are we running out of painters? Are we running out of plumbers? Are we running out of roofer? I mean, what are we not doing? And they'll say, oh my God, if you could sign yourself up to be a this distribution supplier, you would kill it. Boom. There's your answer, right?
Right.
It's as simple as finding out what people aren't doing and filling those voids. And by the way, ditch digging was number 99 out of a list of 100 things that I wanted to do when I grew up, but it worked out. And I did it because I could control all the things that we've been talking about this whole time. So it's not necessarily what you do for a living. It's how well you live with doing what you're doing that makes all the difference.
That's all the time we got. Guys, get the book, Blue Collar Cash. It's everywhere. It's where all the books are. Amazon. I listen to it on Spotify, but I'm sure you can find it at every place you get books. Ken, where can people kind of follow along on your journey? Are you a LinkedIn guy? Do you have a website? What's the best way to connect with you?
Yeah, you can find the course and the book at kenrusk.com. You can see what we're doing there. I also donate the proceeds to a lot of that stuff to the veterans. So you can go to veteransuccess.org and help us to help a veteran see the benefits of the blue collar trade. And you can also go to @KenRuskOfficial on all the socials and you'll find me there as well.
I really appreciate the time today. This was really enlightening and congrats on the book. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Benji.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.